We continue to struggle in our society with the proper treatment of people with either mental illness or intellectual disabilities. We've largely stopped calling them rude names and reduced the populations of the large institutions. But what else? One example of what not to do comes in a new book by Dan Barry called The Boys in the Bunkhouse. They were not boys, but men with intellectual disabilities, and they were kept on a turkey farm doing the dirty work until the operation was busted by police and social workers. Dan Barry's a journalist, now working as a reporter and columnist for the New York Times. Earlier, he was part of a team that won a Pulitzer Prize at the Providence Journal for an investigation of the justice system in Rhode Island. Dan is the author of three previous books, including Bottom of the 33rd, about an endless minor league baseball game. Dan Barry, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
You know, something about design of the book cover and the nature of the story can lead a reader to believe the events took place in 1963 or something, but when did the social workers bust this operation?
I know, it has kind of a Dickensian feel to it, evokes the 30s, but in fact, the gig was up for this operation in 2009.
Wow, so just 7 years ago now. And what did social workers and police find when they got to Adelissa, Iowa? We'll explain the Iowa-Texas connection later on, but the bus took place in Iowa.
They found an old schoolhouse on the top of the hill of a very small farming community in Iowa called Adelissa. And in that house were two dozen or so men with intellectual disability living in squalor. Many of them had been neglected and were physically and emotionally scarred.
And I noticed a lot of them missing teeth, things like that. They obviously hadn't been receiving regular medical and dental care.
Right, that's true. So they had very serious dental issues. They had fungus growing up their legs, and many of them had constricted hands. Their hands were almost claw-like, and that was as a result of what they had been doing for the last 35 years, which was to be eviscerating turkeys in a meat processing plant about 3 or 4 miles from the old schoolhouse.
Wow, 35 years this went on. The Natalie Neal McLaughlin, who is the investigator for the Department of Human Services in Iowa, had a what-the-F moment. Talk about the whole, what she related to you about the breaking of the awareness of what she was finding here.
Well, what happened was Natalie was a social worker, and she was on call in February of 2009, and she gets this strange tip, this call that comes in on the hotline, saying that there were a couple of dozen men living in squalor in this old schoolhouse, and they had been financially, emotionally, and physically exploited. And so she didn't know quite what to make of this. She took care of her child care needs, and in the morning she met a couple of police officers in a prearranged site. And then they traveled to Adelissa, to a place none of them had been to before, and they go to the schoolhouse, and she knocks on the door, and someone opens it, and there is a collection of these men in these squalid conditions. And that's her what the F moment, like, what's going on here? And the men were very welcoming, glad to have a stranger come to see them. And so there was a disconnect for her in the pleasant way they greeted her and the unpleasant surroundings in which they were living. And the longer she spent there and the deeper she got into why these conditions were existing, it blew the top of her head off.
Any social worker is going to encounter some squalid conditions and bad situations and
sure.
just tough environments. I mean, how did this compare to anything she had seen before, Natalie Neal McLaughlin?
Right. So she'd been a social worker by that point for about 10 years. And, she had dealt with her fair share of difficult situations, but she had never, ever dealt with anything like this. And neither had her more experienced colleagues. You might come across an isolated case of a person with intellectual disability being exploited or abused, but never had she seen, or never had they seen, say, two dozen of them. And it was clearly an institutional operation that they were stumbling upon.
Now, you are the master of the contrast. So at page 22, we learn that the operator won an award once. For what?
For being a well-regarded employer of people with disabilities, intellectual disabilities, back then in 1968, for employing people with what was called mental retardation.
And so this takes us to Kenneth Henry. What was his story, and how did this whole operation come about in the first place?
Sure. We've begun with the situation in which Natalie and her colleagues stumble upon, and here's why it happened. It's kind of a long, drawn-out story, but in the 1960s, in Texas, there are these institutions called state schools, and that is where Texas would place people with intellectual disability, those people whose families had neither the emotional nor financial wherewithal to meet their needs. So they would go to these institutions, and back in the 60s and early 70s, they were not pleasant places to be. And so the state was trying to figure out how to begin to reintegrate these men and women into society, which is a proper thing to be thinking about. Texas was, in fact, a little slower than other states in coming to this realization. And so they were trying to empty beds. Meanwhile, a couple of hours away was a rancher who needed ranch hands. He needed help on his ranch, particularly with raising turkeys for artificial insemination and for processing turkeys. So they developed a pilot program to take some men from these institutions and put them on his ranch. And it was considered kind of a progressive thought. The men would learn a skill. They would be effectively deinstitutionalized. They would be integrated to some degree into society and back into the community where they rightfully belonged. And so the men were taught how to work with turkeys. And that went on for a couple of years. And then the owner, T.H. Johnson, who was honored for this approach, and his partner, Kenneth Henry, decided, why don't we subcontract these men and send them to places around the country where they could work with turkeys, in other words, at meat processing plants. Some went to Illinois, some went to South Carolina, and a group of men went to Adelissa, Iowa, to work at a turkey processing plant.
That brings us to the boys in the bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. Dan Barry's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange and the author of the book. We'll come back and talk more with Dan and take phone calls and emails from you in a minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dan Barry, reporter and columnist for the New York Times and author of a book called The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. The servitude is a couple of dozen men taken out of mental institutions in Texas, men with intellectual disabilities, taken to Iowa to work in squalid conditions, live in squalid conditions and work in a turkey processing operation, and got exploited. They were living in horrible conditions. They were getting very little money, if any, for what they did. And Dan Barry tells the story of the discovery by the Iowa Department of Human Services just 7 years ago. That's been going on for 35 years. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments about the story as it unfolds. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned that the idea then came to take people who were coming out of the institutional system in Texas and the operation had worked there and then spread them out to other states. So were there still operations going on in places besides Adelissa, Iowa by 2009, Dan?
No, Adelissa was the last one, though in my reporting of this situation, I learned that, in fact, there was another situation in South Carolina as recently as late 2014, where a couple of men were still working in similar conditions in South Carolina beside a turkey plant and living in a kind of a squalid or unpleasant bunkhouse. So it was existing as recently as 2 years ago.
Of the two men who started this operation, T.H. Johnson and Kenneth Henry, still alive. He clearly wanted to tell his side of the story. How does he defend exploiting people with intellectual disabilities?
Right. Mr. Henry, by the way, just passed away about a month and a half ago. But his defense up until his death was that, look, no one else cared about these men. Okay, their families had effectively abandoned most of them. All right. And we took them out of the institutions. We gave them employment. We gave them a kind of a fraternity that they could enjoy. They had outings where they would go camping or they would go to Walmart, and we gave them dignity. No one else cared about them. We took care of them. That's his argument.
This comes back to a step even before the deinstitutionalization process in Texas, and it's Henry's former partner, T.H. Johnson, and the Bracero program. How was that supposed to work?
Right. So you know, during World War II and then up until the early 1960s, ranchers and farmers, particularly in the Southwest, were benefiting from a program called the Bracero program, which allowed Mexican laborers to come across the border and work on farms and ranches. And, you know, it seemed it was sanctioned by both countries. But as this program lasted into the 50s and 60s, it became quite exploitative. And so by 1963 or 64, the American government put an end to it. This left ranchers like T.H. Johnson in a bit of a lurch. He needed ranch hands. He had been relying on this kind of cheap labor. Now that was gone. So in the discussions with these directors of the institutions, it looked like it could be beneficial to both parties. And so Johnson, I think, was motivated in part by need for hands on his ranch, but also I think he was trying to do something good for these men, to get them out of the institutions and teach them a skill and to help them achieve some kind of dignity as he perceived it.
You talked about the exploitations of the Bracero program. And were they generally paid under what was considered the wage of the time?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And they would come across the border and they would live on a ranch or on a farm, and depending on who the boss man was, they could be living in pretty lousy conditions and not being paid very well and not being fed very well. Others, you know, treated their workers very well. So it depended on the luck of the draw.
So which gets us to the situation with the men who were taken out of the institutions in Texas and put to work for T.H. Johnson and Kenneth Henry. Did they receive any money for their efforts?
Right. The arrangement was that they would receive room and board and what was known as in-kind payment. That would be, as I said, a trip to Walmart or a camping trip or maybe a trip to an amusement park. And $65 a month. So in 1974, when this began in Adelissa, Iowa, the men were being paid $65 a month, effectively. And in 2009, when this situation was exposed, they were making $65 a month. And this was allowed, Jeff, under a federal law. Well, there is a federal law that allows for people with disability to be paid at a lower rate. It's proportional. So if Jeff is a non-disabled worker and he works at 100%, say, and Dan Barry has intellectual disability and can only do about 65% of what Jeff does, then he gets paid 65% of Jeff's pay. The problem with that is that it's so ripe for exploitation and abuse, and that's what happened in this situation as the years went by. The men were quite efficient and dedicated at what they did, yet they were never receiving proper pay for their labor.
Dan Barry's our guest on The Exchange. His book is The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. So was this protected under federal law as a sheltered workshop situation or something like that?
You know, it wasn't a sheltered workshop situation as we understand it. It was an arrangement between an employer and these employees. Once the men left Texas and moved to Iowa, they fell into this gray area of who were they in terms of, were they Texas residents or Iowa residents? The company owners, that being T.H. Johnson and Kenneth Henry, never availed themselves of all the programs that were available in Iowa, outreach programs for people with disability and benefits and all that kind of stuff. So the men fell into a kind of a gray area. But I have to say that as soon as they came to Iowa and they set this up, here we are in a schoolhouse, we've tricked it out into a dormitory, they're going to be working at this turkey plant from, you know, dawn until mid-afternoon, and they're going to be paid this way. As soon as that was established, a social worker in 1974 in Iowa said, this is crazy. This is virtual slavery. These men are being denied all sorts of basic rights. This is anathema to what we stand for. And he wrote a scathing memorandum about it, And that memorandum, for some reason, wound up in the wastebasket.
Really? So there was never an official response from the Iowa authorities. They knew about the program. There was an official recognition that the program existed.
Well, as the years went by, time and again, dimes were being dropped, tips were being called in, social workers would visit the place or be told about it. But it fell into this gray area, at least to the Iowa authorities. They couldn't figure out what to make of it. It wasn't really a group home. It wasn't a sheltered workshop. It didn't fit into their regulatory procedures. And so even though there were abuses obviously being taking place, it just never was really properly acted upon. Occasionally, the Department of Labor would step in and say, hey, you're not paying these men their proper wages under that federal law. And the company would say, oh, you're right, and back pay, give the men back pay. But then there would be other ways where that money would wind up back into the company's coffers, and the men would never really receive them. So this happened time and again over the years, and there were a couple of newspaper investigations, including one by the Des Moines Register in about 1979. And it was crazy. You know, here are these men. They're denied basic rights. In other words, Dan Barry wasn't allowed to say, hey, I don't want to get up this morning and work. He had to work. Hey, I want to live somewhere else. No, you're going to live here. Hey, I want to go and have a girlfriend in town. No, you can't have girlfriends. So these are basic rights that were being denied to them while the Americans with Disability Act was granting and securing proper rights for everybody elsewhere in the country who had disability.
The original turkey operation started in Texas in the 60s, is that right? Is that when it was?
What they originally started with was a turkey, an artificial insemination program. You know, the turkey that we eat, you know, it mostly comes from turkeys who have been bred in a certain way, so we have a lot more white meat, and that requires all sorts of artificial insemination because the turkeys are now, you know, kind of distorted in the way they look, and they have problems with copulation. Yeah, they can't reach. There's all sorts of problems. And so that's what they initially were doing. The men's initial job, the initial skill that they were learning, was to catch turkeys. And it's a difficult job, I'm telling you, to try and catch turkeys that don't want to be caught or touched or anything like that. And that's what these men became proficient at initially.
Dan Barry, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. They were not boys. They were men with intellectual disabilities who were essentially kept captive working at an operation in Iowa up until 2009 when they were finally busted. You can join us on the Exchange as we talk about the situation and talk about our approaches to people with intellectual disabilities in America today. 800-838-3760, the phone number, email address jx@jeffnet.org. What I'm trying to get here is a fix in time. I mean, at the time that the men were first taken out of the state schools, we called them training schools in Connecticut when my mother worked at one. If we'd changed a little bit by that point. I mean, we had Adam Cohen here a few weeks ago talking about imbeciles, the Supreme Court, American eugenics, and sterilization of Carrie Buck. We'd at least retreated from eugenics by the time that this operation started, hadn't we?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But in the 1960s and early 1970s, and I worked in Connecticut as well, and I'm familiar with the training schools, and I'm from New York, so I know all about Willowbrook and the like. So by the late 60s and early 70s, sure, there was a realization that there had to be a better way. There had to be a better way. But having said that, these were not places that you would want to be in. And so the men, you know, you're right. They were called boys, but these are men. They leapt at the chance to leave these institutions, to be outside of those walls and that kind of lifestyle. And so that's what was happening in the late 60s and early 1970s.
So in Texas at the beginning, what was supposed to happen in the way of oversight? Who was supposed to check up on them and make sure that the idea of getting them out of the training schools was going to give them a better life?
Right. So for the first 6 months, say Dan Barry would go to T.H. Johnson's ranch, and for the first 6 months or maybe up until a year, the Texas authorities would check on Dan, okay, and see that everything was all right and fine. And then after a certain period of time, Dan would receive a letter saying you are now, released and we wish you the best, sincerely, Texas. And of course, the problem was that that Dan probably couldn't read the letter he had just received. I know that in the cases of many of the men that I've come to know in the course of this. So Texas effectively washed its hands of these men. The men are now in society. That's how it was perceived.
Let's talk about some of the men that you had a chance to meet here. Willie Levi's name certainly jumps to the forefront, and as you pointed out, he could not read his letter. Tell us about your interactions with Willie, and he seemed to take a real pride in his work.
Sure. So he came from Orange, Texas. His mother and father struggled to raise him. His father was an alcoholic. His mother had depression. And by the time he was in his teens, there was no one to care for him properly in the Levi family. And so he went to the Texas institutions. He went to Abilene. He went to Mejia, Texas. And so he participated in this program, and he became very gifted at communicating with the turkeys. One of his jobs was to unload live turkeys from the crates that you'll see on the highway. You know, you see these trucks with crates of poultry, live poultry. His job, once the trucks came into the bay at the turkey processing plant, his job was to unload those turkeys, and they weighed 40 to 50 pounds. They were not happy turkeys. And his job was to calm them down and soothe them, and then grab them and turn them upside down and hang them on these shackles that would swing into the assembly plant, you know, where they would be stunned and killed and then eviscerated. And he had a way of communicating with them. He could talk turkey, but not in a childlike way. He could sound like a turkey, and he would kind of sing song to them. It's all right, Tom. It's all right, Tom. And that was one of his gifts.
How much did he remember about his life before either the institution or the turkey operation? And did he have any contact with his family?
Right. He from the moment he was dropped off at the Mejia State School, he wanted to go back home to Orange, Texas. And this became and remains a theme in his life. He has always wanted to go back to Orange, Texas. But his family, his loved ones have died off or moved away or are no longer in touch. And so he had no communication with his family from, you know, the mid-70s up until this day. And so that's a theme for Levi, always wanting to go home, but he was never able to, and there was really the Orange that he left is no longer there. And that's who he is. He talks about it constantly. And like many of the other men, you know, he will tell you specifically about this cousin or this event that happened in the school and on and on. The problem with him, at least, and with many of the other men, is they struggle with time continuum. So if you ask Willie Levi, hey, Willie, when did you come to the Atlassa farmhouse or the schoolhouse, rather? And he would say, I've been here about a year, or I've been here about 5 months, 6 months, when in fact it could be 35 years. That's where he struggles in placing it in time. But everything else that he will tell you is spot on.
Dan Barry's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Boys in the Bunkhouse. How much were he or any of the other men around him aware of the money they should have been getting for what they were doing?
T.H. Johnson used to walk around the bunkhouse. So these men would get up at 3:30 in the morning, and then they would work all day at this lousy job. So let's just say that working in a turkey processing plant is not always pleasant. They had the least pleasant jobs. They had the worst jobs in that plant, unloading the turkeys and eviscerating them. Okay, and so Johnson used to walk around the bunkhouse with a billfold in his shirt pocket, and it would be, you know, spilling over with money. And so he would say to Levi, hey, Levi, come over here. Hey, go down to the mini mart and get me some sardines. And here's $10 and keep the change. So that's the money that they understood and appreciated. It wasn't until after all this was exposed did they realize how financially exploited they had been.
T.H. Johnson winning this award actually for employing people coming out of the institutions in Texas. I can imagine that this award might have spurred other operations. I mean, were there parallel things like the Johnson Henry operation elsewhere in Texas?
Not that I know of. I think there were other job opportunities, but nothing quite like this as far as I know. And, you know, so he receives this award in 1968 from the organization that was known then as, I think, the Association for Retarded Children. You know, he was perceived as a progressive. He was someone who seemed to be willing to take a chance in employing people with disabilities. And so that's what he was being honored for. But fairly quickly on, it was realized, well, this isn't the best situation. It isn't as great as we thought it was initially.
All right. So any idea how many people ended up coming out of institutions to work for places like that? I mean, I get the impression of this pipeline just opening up and belching out men.
Right. It did. It did for many years. Dozens, if not a couple of hundred men cycled through the Henry's Turkey Service program. You know, some of them didn't like it, and they expressed that, and they would go back to the institution, or they might, their families might accept them, or return them home. But a lot of these guys, this is what they did for their entire adult lives.
They're described in The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. Dan Barry from the New York Times is the author of the book and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Welcome back and talk more with Dan. And if you'd like to join the conversation with some observations about how we care for people with intellectual disabilities in America, you're welcome to join in. Back on the Exchange with Dan Barry and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dan Barry from the New York Times, reporter and columnist, Pulitzer winner as part of a team at the Providence Journal 20-plus years ago for investigative reporting. His latest book is called The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. These aren't boys he's written about. They were grown men with intellectual disabilities who had been taken out of the Texas institutions and ended up working at a turkey processing operation in Iowa for 35 years for pretty much no pay and in squalid conditions. Finally busted in 2009. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions, comments, observations about how we treat people with intellectual disabilities in America. Welcome at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. You'd mentioned that some people didn't like working at the operation and ended up going back to the state schools in Texas. What happened when some of the workers got too sick or too old to do the job?
They would go back to Texas to, you know, less than wonderful nursing homes, and that's what happened here. So this went on for 35 years, and as the years go by, they're living in kind of like amber around the world, around outside of the schoolhouse. All sorts of rights are properly being realized by people with disability, except for these men. And they're getting older and older. They're still being called boys. And finally, in 2009, the T.H. Johnson has died, but the remaining owner, Kenneth Henry, said, let's shut it down. Let's retire the men. So that's interesting, too. The men don't have a say in whether they're going to be retired. They're being told they're going to be retired. And as the operation was winding down, these men now are in their late 50s, 60s, even in their 70s. And so the plan was to send them back to Texas to live in nursing homes. But there were a couple of families who were still involved in the lives of these men, and the company called one of the sisters and said, this is what we're going to do with Keith. We're going to send him to a nursing home in Texas. And she wanted no part of that. And she said, by the way, Keith has been working for you guys for 30-odd years. How much money does he have in the bank? And the answer was $86. And so she went ballistic. And she called everybody she could think of in Iowa, save the National Guard. And she also called an investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register. And that's what led to this garbage can being tipped over in February of 2009. And that's why Natalie Neal McLaughlin, the social worker, went there that morning with a couple of police officers. And by afternoon, the place was like a crime scene with all sorts of federal officials and social workers and investigators crawling through this squalid schoolhouse.
So that again is in 2009. As you mentioned, there was a worker for the Department of Human Services in Iowa who sounded a warning bell in 1974. There were a couple of investigative reports about Henry's Turkey Service and the Des Moines Register in 1979, and yet it still took 30 years to do something?
Yes. I can't give you any kind of answer for why that happened. As I said, this operation was neither a group home nor a sheltered workshop as we understand it or as the regulations describe them. And so it kind of fell into this gray area. And also everyone thought that the men were being taken care of properly. You know, this kind of condescension that is applied oftentimes with people with disability. Oh, look, those boys look quite happy up there on the hill. Oh, and look, they're at the tavern and they're having a root beer. They're having a beer after a long day's work at the turkey plant. And everything seems fine. And what happened was society wasn't, the community was not noticing, oh, well, Levi is limping. Dan is missing a few teeth. Their hands are constricted. They're not clean. It wasn't noticed. And it wasn't until the relative dropped a dime that the thing was really seen clearly for the first time.
We have an email here from Vajra in Sunny Valley. She asks the good question, what has been done to the perpetrators of this travesty? Are any of them in jail? Is there any real justice?
Well, it depends on how you define justice. So what happened was after they were rescued, and it was a kind of a rescue, the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission filed a lawsuit on their behalf, and they prevailed. And the central point here was that the men had been denied the happiness of life, which is really a wonderful phrase, the happiness. They've been denied the happiness of life and the enjoyment of life. So a big jury award was granted to the men of $240 million. That got knocked down by caps on jury awards. And so it was only in the last month or two that the men realized any money from the lawsuit verdict. Was there any criminal charges ever pressed against any of the people who ran this operation? No. No one has ever been criminally charged.
Wow. And in fact, before his death, you talked to Kenneth Henry, who was a free man in Texas. And this is the part that really gets interesting to think about, is Kenneth Henry tearing up in talking to you about the men? I mean, what did he think he was doing for them?
You know, it's easy to portray people as black hats or white hats or good or bad. You know, there's a lot of that area in the middle between those two points. And I think Kenneth Henry was in that middle, at least in his mind. I think he, and certainly, definitely T.H. Johnson, had great affection for these men, okay? Johnson did. Henry didn't know them as well, but he did tear up when I spoke to him at length about this because he was thinking that he had done right by these guys, and he had stepped in, he and T.H. Johnson had stepped in and cared for these men when no one else would have and did. And so now here he was being pilloried for not taking care of them properly. And he felt, I think, entirely misunderstood.
People did try to leave the operation over the years, Willie Levi included. And we come to Willie several times in the book. What happened to those circumstances? What happened to Willie?
He would try to run away and he would be, you know, captured and brought back. Sometimes they would call the sheriffs and say, hey, Gene Berg just left the property and they would find him on the road, and they would bring him back. But in 1986, one of the men was punished or disciplined because he had done something improper at the plant while working, and he was told he was not allowed to watch television and that he had to go to his room. So this is what a 40-year-old man was being told. He could not watch television. He was going to his room, which is, you would never say that to a non-disabled man, but this is what was being told to this guy. And his name was Alfred Busby, and in the morning he ran away. The problem was that it was January in Iowa, and the temperatures were about zero or below, and he disappeared. And it wasn't until 4 months later or so, 3 or 4 months later, that they found his body in a field, and his body looked like a scarecrow. He had run away, frozen to death, and was there until the spring thaw.
Huh. So Wow. At that point, it seems like maybe criminal neglect or something could be a charge that would be given in a case like that. There were Department of Labor investigations in addition to some of the newspaper reports that came out over the years. What became of those?
Usually they would fine the operation. They would fine Henry's Turkey Service and say, you know, you owe these men this much in back pay. They would examine how the company was applying that federal law allowing for less pay for people with disability. They would find violations and they would say, you have to pay these men this amount. And so the company would pay the money back to the men, but the company also had control over the men's bank accounts, and so the money would effectively be funneled back into the company's operations.
Which raises the question about what, and the Grumpy John and Grants Pass emails this question as well, what kinds of profits was the company making? I mean, were they clearing a lot of money based on this? Is there argument that they couldn't have made a profit dealing with regular workers at regular fair wages?
Yeah, you know, over the years, the company would talk about turning this into a nonprofit enterprise, but that never happened. This was a for-profit organization, or rather a for-profit company, and they made money off it. There's no question. Did they make millions off it? No, but they made quite a good bit of money off the arrangement for many years.
Phone call here from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dan Barry, the author of The Boys in the Bunkhouse.
Good morning. The question that I have that's on my mind is that this is all, I mean, it's a phenomenal case and it's tip of an iceberg. But at the bottom of that iceberg is the average person whose mental makeup allows for this to happen. I mean, Kenneth and what Johnson and those two, they just did something, and they did wrong, and they had their justifications for it. And but why the human mind that we all share, why is it capable of doing this to people, and what can we as a society, or what can you, talking about this book, do to, in a way, teach, wake up people to, wait a minute, nobody is a nobody is a is an animal. Nobody, even animals aren't just property.
All right, so wake up and smell the exploitation. Thanks for that, Wolfgang. Dan, where do we go
from
here?
That's a good question, Wolfgang. That's a good observation. Here's what I think. I think that society looks at people with intellectual disability in this kind of frame of otherness, and there's an intellectual segregation that occurs, and it allows for this kind of abuse. So there's this otherness that exists that should not exist between the non-disabled, quote-unquote, non-disabled world and people with intellectual disability that allows for this, okay? We have to get past that. We have to get to the inclusion, the full inclusion aspect of our society rather than having remnants of segregation. That's one. And two, I think, you know, are we our brothers' keepers? Are we our brothers' and sisters' keepers? I think we have to remain vigilant for those in our society who are vulnerable and make sure that they're being taken care of and are living well and among us. And that wasn't happening in this case.
This particular realm seems a very hard one to get people to stop thinking about in the terms you were just talking about. In fact, I can think just within the last five, maybe within the last 2 years even, hearing somebody use a phrase that included the TARD in it somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, and that word, the R word now, you know, part of the book goes off, explains the language that we have used for people with intellectual disability, you know, since the time of Plato. You know, if you think about it, they're still inscribed in granite on buildings around the country, you know, idiot, imbecile, retarded, all these words, and all of them are condescending and separating. And so we have to get past the language as well. I think that's true.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking when Adam Cohen was here talking about imbeciles, that it was Louis Brandeis who gave the decision in the Carrie Buck case when it reached the Supreme Court, was saying three generations of imbeciles is enough. But that was the language used then.
Right, that was a justification for eugenics at that time. You're right.
Yeah. So is it possible that there are other operations like the Boys in the Bunkhouse still going on elsewhere in the country still?
You know, I think it is possible. If you and I were having this discussion 7 years ago, you and I would not believe that this was occurring in 2009. And as I said at the start of our talk, that what happened was Natalie and her colleague kept saying, look, Dan, this isn't the only one. We're finding some records, and one of the men who lives here, one of the men, the boys, quote-unquote boys, has a brother who came out of the same system, and checks are being sent, disability checks are being sent to his address at Lewis Rich Boulevard in Newberry, South Carolina. And they kept saying, you got to go there, you got to go there, it's still going on. And I'll be honest with you, I resisted for several months. I just didn't want to go to Newberry, South Carolina. But my Irish Catholic guilt got the better of me, and I finally went to Newberry, South Carolina. And I go down Lewis Rich Boulevard, and Lewis Rich is a famous processing company, right? And there is a turkey plant to my left, and I turn right, and here is a collection of squalid little mobile homes, you know, similar to a bunkhouse. I knock on the door, and here comes Leon Jones, who is the brother of one of the men that I've gotten to know in Annalisa. And his job was to work at that plant across the street, picking up the DOAs. In other words, he would pick up the turkeys that were dead by the time they arrived on those trucks. And he was being paid nothing, and he was living in an open room where he had maybe 6 square feet of living space. He had a bed, a very small nightstand, and that was it. And this man was in his mid-60s. So the idea that this 2009 case was some kind of aberration or one-off, I don't think is true.
It's a very powerful book, and we really appreciate the time you spent with us today talking about it. The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. Dan Barry, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
All right, take care.